There's the big board, the 20 electoral votes from the state of Pennsylvania. We just got new metrics in.
Right now, a historic moment. We can now project the winner of the presidential race.
The inauguration of a president celebrates a peaceful transition of power engineered by the American voters.
The president-elect of the United States of America, Donald Trump.
Donald J. Trump is the president of the United States elect.
This is a political upset of huge, huge magnitude.
Country still divided.
This is your life now. This is our election now. This is us. This is our country. It's real.
Hi and welcome, listeners of the 45th podcast. I am back. This is Rabia. I'm here with Susan Simpson and Sara Basha. Hi, ladies.
Hi, guys.
Hey.
It has been yet another breakneck crazy week. Obviously, lots of things related to Russia, which we are going to discuss. But there are some stories that have maybe fallen through the cracks, and I wanted to just touch on them very quickly. A couple of things that caught my attention. Number one, I thought this is kind of a major story, and that is that the more detailed education budget, it shows that DeVos, who is Secretary of Education, that they are planning to slash over $1 billion, with a B, $1 billion in funding for all kinds of programs, including after-school programs, including money that's allocated towards a fund that gives schools funding to teach advanced placement courses, provide mental health services, physical education, science and engineering instruction. They're going to be cutting 40 jobs, 40 positions from the Office of Civil Rights. And these positions are related to looking at discrimination against students in education. And, you know, many of these cuts are going to impact mostly minority students and poor students, underserved students already. And so this is really, I think, you know, $1 billion is no joke. That's a lot of money.
Well, it impacts working families, because a lot of parents rely on after school programs and stuff like that. So it hits middle America too.
Oh, absolutely. And I when I see this kind of like move, I don't understand it, even ideologically, you know. They're saying that the money's getting shifted toward like school choice type of stuff. But how do they not understand like what kind of impact this is going to have directly on children? And
they do. They just think that it's immoral to have any kind of government involvement in human affairs, basically.
You know,
any involvement that involves helping people, essentially.
Helping people, right? But then legislating against things like marijuana. I mean, like, you know, it's not completely true. It's just like a pick and choose situation. But another story that I keep seeing over and over again, and this morning I was reading a couple of different stories about that too, is like the really low morale at the White House and staff, and how staffers are like, you know, first of all, they're terrified of Trump and his temper. And apparently they're in a situation where, I mean, it's been reported repeatedly that nobody can actually advise Trump. He gets angry or he just won't take the advice. So people have stopped doing that. They're just kind of ducking into their own spaces and they're looking for ways out and new jobs. So there apparently are threats from Trump that when he gets back from this big overseas trip, which we're going to talk about, there's going to be some major shakeups, including, I mean, we keep hearing Spicer's job is going to be on the chopping block. So I don't know about
that. Spicer's so gone at some point.
You think so? What do you think he did at the Bushes?
I think it's the fact that he's not like appealing to see on TV, which is all Trump cares about.
Well, how do you think Sarah Huckabee is doing?
He'll like her for a little bit and then he won't like her anymore. There's no one who can do the role he wants to be done. It's
why he's going to
scale back. Yeah.
It's a tough job to do because you have so much to deal with, and you have to kind of frame things in a way where you have to kind of do damage control 24/7 when you're speaking.
You mean lie?
Yeah, but then concurrent threats that he's just going to end these press briefings altogether. So that's also a possibility.
I think it's possible when he gets back from the trip, there'll be no more press briefings.
Yeah,
I think this is also classic of the fact that the question is, does anyone want to do the job? I feel like people are running away.
There's always someone, though.
It's like a brain drain. Yeah,
it is a brain drain, but you can always find someone. But did you guys see the article about how, since staffers are having a hard time influencing Trump, they are now resorting to using fake news on purpose?
That was really alarming. Yeah.
Yeah. Who was it? KT McFarland, who put in like a global warming hoax article to piss off Trump. And it worked until someone told him it was fake.
You know, guys, I wanted to say something. I mean, I get like Washington Post alerts on my phone or by email, and I'm actually very sick and tired of getting about 5 or 6 of them a day. And I get that this is a crazy time we live in, but also I think the media is sometimes frothing at the mouth. They'll do things like they'll put these headlines or send an email out that says, this may have happened in this time frame, and we don't really know this, but we're just putting it out there. And it just makes me annoyed. I get that it's media's job to call things out, to be responsible, to hold, you know, powers that be accountable. But at the same time, sometimes it looks like they're just in a frenzy to pull this down. They want it down now. And it's hard for us to see where we should be a little bit more nuanced and calm about things and where we should be panicking.
But at the same time, is there like an example you're thinking of? Because the articles, there have been a lot of them, that's for sure. A crazy, insane amount. But there are also things that are huge, nation-shaking things.
Yeah, but I feel like they're hidden sometimes because there's like one out every 2 minutes.
But that's not their fault. They're actually trying to keep track of what's happening, which is insane.
Some of them, but some of them are like, this person had asked Trump to do this in X, you know, this
many
years ago.
It's like minute by minute. I think that's what, yes. You know what it is? I'm somewhere in the middle. The thing is, there's a couple of different things happening. Number one, they have to fill a 24-hour news cycle. Number two, this administration, the frothing at the mouth goes both ways, right? So this administration is giving the media every single reason to be at their throat constantly. Right, like he calls them public enemy before he was even in office. Public enemy number one. You can't do that if you're, you know, if he maybe didn't create that relationship, maybe they'd be a little more measured. I do agree. There are many times I see headlines and I click on the article. I'm like, okay, that's pretty much the same thing that I like you put in another story with like one additional sentence, like you said.
Yeah, look at this one from May 18th, Thursday, May 18th. Asked whether he urged Comey to back off Flynn investigation, Trump tells news conference, no, no, next question. I'm like, that's not breaking news. Seriously, sometimes I get annoyed. I'm like, okay, I get that.
I wouldn't be annoyed at them.
The president's lying.
The president's like saying that it's equivalent of, I mean, like, that's how jaded we've gotten. That is the equivalent of Nixon's I am not a crook. And we're like, really? We're reporting that Nixon said that?
Right. That's true, too. I think we are getting a little bit jaded. But I see both your points. One last thing I want to mention that caught my eye this week, and I thought this was a bit of good news in the big garbage fire that's just keeps fanning and blown up, is that there was a bipartisan bill introduced in response to Jeff Sessions' announcement of like doubling down on and rolling back Obama's effort to get rid of mandatory minimum sentencing. And so this bill is called the Justice Safety Valve Act, and it gives federal judges the ability to impose sentences below the mandatory minimums when they deem it appropriate. But it's a bipartisan bill, and I think that's some good news.
Remember I said...
I missed that.
I had observed that, it's a known thing that the previous move by Sessions was giving more power to the prosecutors and taking power away from judges. So I think this kind of addresses that in some ways. It allows judges to have that sort of say as to whether they can impose a sentence other than what's being put out there.
Think that it gave prosecutors leverage over defendants.
Freedom,
I don't,
not power.
Yeah, not necessarily freedom, but I see what you're saying. I mean, like it did, yeah.
Leverage,
I mean, like,
is a word.
Yeah. We are living in unique times. I have to wonder if ever before people have paid such close attention to politics, global affairs, social and criminal justice. And so it's important to understand the history and circumstances that brought us here. Now I'm doing that by watching this great video lecture series from The Great Courses Plus. With this wonderful video learning service, you will get unlimited access to learn more about everything that interests you, including everything I just mentioned, from the world's greatest professors. There are over 8,000 lectures to choose from on topics like politics, history, psychology, cooking, photography. And now you can stream The Great Courses Plus on any smartphone, tablet, laptop, and TV, or you can download the videos and watch them offline. Now, I want you guys to check out a fascinating course that I'm following lately. It's called Forensic History, Crimes, Frauds, and Scandals. Now, there's a lot going on in politics nowadays that might call for you to get a little bit of in-depth knowledge on these issues. And one of the lectures in the series is called The Bad Boys of U.S. Politics. This lecture explores the presidency of Warren G. Harding, who was the 29th president, and his presidency was fraught with corruption and controversy. You thought things were bad now, but we're talking about extramarital affairs, extortion, crooked cabinet members, even suspicious debts. Now, I know the headlines are not good enough for our listeners, so I'm telling you, if you sign up right now for the Great Courses Plus, you can watch this and any one of the courses free for an entire month, but you need to go to my special URL, which is thegreatcoursesplus.com/45. You can get an entire month free of all the video lecture series, including this one and any others that interest you, for an entire month. So sign up at thegreatcoursesplus.com/45. Remember, it's thegreatcoursesplus.com/45. What I really want to talk about, like the bulk of what I want to talk about, is what happened really, I think, right after we recorded our last episode, which was the meeting, the Trump meeting with the Russian foreign minister and ambassador Kislyak. Now, we talked about this a little bit, but what happened right after we recorded, I think it was the very next day, was that the story broke that Trump had passed on information, classified information, during that meeting to the Russians, okay? Just to refresh people's memory, the day after Comey was fired, apparently Putin requested to Trump that he meet with the ambassador and the foreign minister. And, you know, we talked about this last week. No American press was there. There was some Russian press there. They took some pictures and put them in their media, and then the White House was somehow outraged. I don't know why they did not realize that there's a photographer there. But somebody very close in the circle, actually apparently somebody who was in the room at the time, leaked to the Washington Post that during the meeting, Trump spilled something called code word level information to the Russians. So I want to talk about first what that means. There are different levels of classified information, and I'm pulling this from The Atlantic, but, you know, lots of people reporting on this. And here's how it goes. There's three basic levels of classified information. You start off with confidential information, and that's defined as anything that could be reasonably expected to, quote, cause damage to American national security if it's shared without authorization. The next step up is secret information. And that's considered to have the potential to cause, quote, serious damage if it's revealed. Then you go to top secret information. That's a higher classification level. And that's anything that could reasonably be expected to cause, quote, exceptionally grave damage to U.S. national security if revealed. So code word goes beyond top secret. It is higher than top secret, and it limits access to classified information to a very, very narrow pool of people who have to actually have a code word, like access to some kind of code word to even get that information. So it provides like a really big layer of security, and you know, lots of secrets are super secrets. In The Atlantic, they reported that, you know, when Harry Truman was vice president, he didn't know about the Manhattan Project. He learned about it only after President Roosevelt died and he was sworn in as president, because that was code word classified. It's so, so far off the scale. Okay. Now, the plot twist here is this. Yes, Trump did give this information, and we'll talk about the actual information, to the Russians, but the president of the United States can declassify anything he wants. So the minute he makes it public, it's become declassified, and he can do it anytime. And apparently he hasn't really broken any laws when he does that.
With the possible caveat in this case, in that it wasn't America's information to give. So it's not that he's breaking, it's not the classification issue here. It's the fact it was a ally, like another nation's information that we had agreements with them about how we'd handle. So
yeah, but even in that case, I don't know if it was necessary. I mean, that has its consequences. We'll talk about that. But I don't think he necessarily broke any law, like in terms of...
We don't know what the agreement was there, but the president cannot unilaterally violate treaties or agreements with other nations.
Well, okay, yeah, so there is
funny,
that.
It's funny how a lot of these things are like borderline illegal, and then we can never really pack it down. It kind of seems like, well, that's always the conundrum.
Who cares if it's illegal? Like, it's also really stupid and
horrific.
It's
stupid,
so.
Right. There is that. Okay, so let's talk about what that secret was. The intelligence that he gave to the Russians was that somewhere in Syria, there's this ISIS cell that's developing a method to use laptops as explosive devices on flights coming to the U.S. Now, to be clear, Trump did not reveal where the intelligence came from, like who the source was, or what the method of collecting it was. But like you said, Susan, the bigger issue was that it came from an ally. And the big concern when this broke was that that ally and intelligence agencies in general were horrified, because the nature of the information was such that if the Russians were savvy enough, they could actually figure out who the source was and what the methodology was. And that completely compromises the asset collecting it and that channel of intel collection. And of course, there's also the fallout that that ally might not share the intelligence again.
And also that asset is at risk of being killed.
That asset is at risk of being killed. And in this case, that ally is a major ally of the United States, and it was Israel. Where Trump is going. And, you know, I don't know if you guys know, but a little bit of an incident happened with Trump already in Israel. He wanted to land his helicopter on top of this ancient fort, a UNESCO heritage site called Masada.
Yeah.
And the other presidents have given speeches there, but what they do is they land at the base, they take a cable park car up. He wanted to land his helicopter there, and they were like, you cannot do that. So he just canceled it altogether. Crazy.
What?
He canceled that. He's going to give a speech in Jerusalem.
But they couldn't fly his helicopter, so he just said, no, I'm not doing it.
He wanted to land on a UNESCO heritage site. Okay.
Wait, was there some security reasons why or what?
Damaged to archaeological site.
No. She's asking, is there a security reason he wanted to land there directly?
I don't want to take that whatever. I don't want to travel up the building. I think that's what it is.
I think the cable car was just really below him, beneath him. Or maybe he's terrified.
Maybe Theresa May can hold his hand.
Right. Wow. Maybe he was a little bit scared. But anyway, I'll talk about a little bit about Israel. But what happened after this report broke is initially, you know, why the White House denied the report. The Deputy National Security Advisor, Dina Powell, flatly denied it. But then McMaster, who's the NSA, National Security Advisor, and Tillerson, you know, Secretary of State, they did deny it, but they kind of qualified their denials. They're like, well, you know, the methods and the source was not revealed, but they didn't say the intel was not revealed. Then Trump himself went out and tweeted, yeah, I gave it to the Russians, so what? So here's the two things that make me wonder about, like, how this actually went down. Number one is this. The source of the intelligence was Israel, right? Now, apparently, this was reported in Israeli media, and it was reported back in January before the inauguration that Israel was warned by U.S. intelligence agencies before the inauguration not to share highly sensitive information with this administration. They said, number one, don't do it until and unless the Russia probe is over. But the danger of you doing it is that the administration could pass the intel on to Russia, who then could pass it on to their ally, Iran, of course, Israel's arch enemy. Now, Mossad is the Israeli intelligence agency, and they are one of the best in the world. It's very hard for me to believe that after having been given this warning, number one, and themselves following what's happening with the Russia investigation, with Russia's close ties to Iran, that they would actually hand over intelligence that would actually really put any of their assets in danger.
They may have had no choice, though. I mean, I'm sure they weren't thrilled about it, but this is also information that affects a very important ally for them, the interest of the United States of America. I mean, there's someone apparently having a direct plan they're getting close to accomplishing to put a bomb on a U.S.-bound plane. They couldn't just not tell America and then be afterwards like, sorry, I would have told you, but Trump.
They could have told America, and that's the thing. You know, I was speaking to an ex-intelligence officer, I'm not going to say who it is, but and he said that, you know, he was surprised at this, but he said that they actually could have shared this intel with our intelligence services, but not necessarily the administration. And I think that kind of stuff is happening right now, where our own intelligence agencies are not sharing everything with Trump. So I think there was a way around it, but I'm not saying it didn't happen. I'm just saying that they shared something. I just wonder if they did it knowing that, you know what, this could be compromised and we're okay. Like, you know, I just can't imagine them. Mossad is sharp, man. Israeli intelligence is one of the most sophisticated, like, agencies in the world.
They can't control what our agencies do, though.
They can't, but they can control what they hand over to the president, at least. I mean, but anyway, the other part of this puzzle...
It's really uncomfortable how the intelligence community has to work separately from the White House on this. I mean, we've known for a while, ever since his attacks on them, that there's been tension. But the fact that when these real big issues come up, we don't feel secure that they're working in tandem.
Yeah, well, they're not. And you know, our own intelligence agent, there's been reporting in the past that sources have said, we are absolutely not going to... We're going to be careful what we share with the administration. These agencies and these professionals have been there for decades, and they're going to continue to be there. And I think that they are trying to even protect this country from the administration, the harm the administration could do. The other thing I wanted to look at is like who could have leaked this to the press, because there's only a few people in the room apparently when this happened. There's Rex Tillerson, who, let's not forget, was Putin's man of the year at some point. There's a McMaster, and there's somebody else, a third person apparently, that I don't know who it was. But if we look at McMaster, I think it's important to look at his background, because he was not just...
That's not the only pool, though. Keep in mind, they had to instantly go into like repair mode and to alert, well,
right,
Israel. So it's a bigger pool here. And also the Israelis themselves could have leaked it.
That's, well, yeah, if the Israelis were told by somebody
they
in
were.
This pool.
They had to be told. They were to be told.
Yeah.
That was part of what happened.
That's true. So there was some kind of memo that was written up, and then there was discussion in the White House about like altering the memo for public consumption, and then somebody there actually picked up the phone. They called the CIA and other intelligence agencies to say that a security breach might have taken place. But I do want to talk a little bit about McMaster's background. I'm not saying he was the leak. What I'm saying is his background, I mean, he's highly decorated, very respected, but he's also a PhD scholar, and he's considered one of the military's top intellectuals. He wrote the book on standing up, on military standing up to presidential power called Dereliction of Duty long ago. But here's an interesting tidbit about him. That he was the director before he joined the Trump administration, not long ago, just in the last couple of years, of something called the Army Capabilities Integration Center. And his job there was to figure out what the Army should look like in 2025. And in this position, he led a secret Army study that was his own brainchild. It was called the Russia New Fair Army Study. And it studied Russia's invasion of the Ukraine in 2014, and it was designed to figure out how the U.S. Army should adapt to Russia's military advances. So McMaster here, you know, spent a lot of time thinking about Russia, like preparing our forces against Russian military advancement, and now he has to be the NSA for a president who is so, so close to Russia. Apparently, one way he prepared for this particular study was he revisited, there was a study conducted after the Yom Kippur War, which was between Israel and the proxies of the Soviet Union, Egypt and Syria. And so he picked that back up and used that as kind of a framework to develop this study. Drawing on kind of Israeli sources for that. So if you think about like the players here, Israel, Russia, I don't know.
I think since McMaster came on board, there has been a sort of more reserved attitude towards Russia.
What are you saying? He had Kislyak and everything.
I think McMaster has been influential in getting the president to understand because of his experience in knowing Russia inside and out that we shouldn't be this kind of chummy with them. I feel like there's been a change ever since he came on board. We've been just a little bit more standoffish, a little bit more.
Notwithstanding the meeting in which he just leaked like code word information, right? There's that.
Also, yeah, Trump is very unhappy with McMaster, and there's been like frequent conflicts between them. So
yeah,
he's the adult in the room, but he's also his position is not secure. I don't know.
It's hard for me to believe that somebody with McMaster's training and background and readiness and awareness of the Russian threat would give cover to this president over giving intel to Russia. Like, that's really hard for me to
agree with you on that. Yeah.
Because everything Trump touches withers and dies.
There might be that. Like, he sucks the soul out of somebody who served the nation for like 50 years. I don't know. Well, maybe. Look, all I know is if he was set up, I say high five to the Israelis and McMaster. But if not, then... yay for his own unraveling. But anyway, so now we are at, you know, after this, all this happened. And what was interesting was like, I think right before this is when Trump threatened Comey with, you know, there might be tapes about a conversation, which makes you think that, you know, Trump is taping everything. And so Congress was like, you know what, if you're taping stuff, we want those tapes and we want a transcript of the meeting. And instead of the White House saying, yeah, sure, Putin said he could supply them. I thought that was crazy.
It's not funny, but it's kind of funny.
that means the Russians were taping the meeting, right? Isn't
that
the only thing that
could mean? Are they just trolling us?
So why do you think they would troll us? I mean, do you think they're just ready
because
to like...
they've been doing it all along. Like, look at their Twitter feeds. Like, they are absolutely trolling us intentionally. It could be true. They could have taped it, but also they could just be fucking with us.
I I mean, I feel like if the White House did not realize somebody was taking pictures, maybe they didn't realize somebody had a big old recorder. But I don't know.
It's very possible. But whether or not they actually recorded it, that's exactly what they'd say to try and just mess with us.
There's so many ways of recording stuff.
Right, there are digital, yeah. Like little. It's easy to
do
it.
Things that you can't even see is not visible to the naked eye, but the point is, we're in such a vulnerable situation. We have a foreign country sitting in the White House saying, hey, we have a taped version of this conversation. And it becomes like, who do we trust on this? And what was said? And how does this compromise us?
Right. But also, you know what I think, what I found interesting about that was that what is Putin trying to signal to Trump then? Like, for him to say that, it means that, you know what, that we're going to make you look like a bigger idiot because it means we recorded and you didn't know, or you're going to be called out because of the intel that you passed, you know, and it could further expose you. Is he signaling to Trump, you are no longer our useful idiot? Like, it feels like he's throwing Trump under the bus.
If McMaster was in the room, you never know. Maybe that was what happened, what was kind of...
Yeah. Well, okay, so now the question is, like, what consequences to Trump, right? I mean, like, it doesn't seem like he broke any laws and there's going to be any consequences, but for this specifically. But I thought this was a crazy report because, you know, he's such a vindictive person. There's been reports that in foreign policy, the administration is planning some kind of revenge for the media frenzy around him leaking this intelligence. And this is exactly what it says. Quote, according to a source with knowledge of a White House meeting that took place Wednesday morning, just a few days ago, Trump's team is considering launching an investigation into a DHS, Department of Homeland Security program that shares information on cyber attacks in an effort to coordinate globally on countering digital threats, insinuating that it inappropriately, meaning the Obama administration, inappropriately opened up streams of sensitive data to Russia and other non-allies. And another option, apparently, in the revenge plan is considering placing a story in the media about the program, similarly accusing it of sharing sensitive information. So it's kind of like, I know you are, but what am I? I mean, like, it's just...
I really like the anonymous staffer who called it a, quote, bag of crazy cats.
A bag of crazy cats. Yep, that's what
you know that
it.
They've been falling back on this notion of there being stragglers from the old administration that are actually out to get him, and so they cause these kind of kerfuffles in between to snag him at some point.
Deep state.
Yeah, but you know, I really feel like their eye is not on the ball here. I mean, the you know, he has so much serious trouble that he could face to go like, we're not going to reach back on the Obama administration and look for times that this might have, you know, they shared information through this established program. It is an established program of sharing intel and data, by the way, between national security agencies internationally. It's just, I just feel like you are really not prioritizing like what's important. Because even though this might not be grounds for impeachment, which has happened, then right after this came the Comey memo, and that might lead to grounds for impeachment. So we know that Trump threatened Comey over Twitter about having tapes. What Trump might not have realized that Comey is apparently a very fastidious memo taker, and he is known throughout his career and agency for drafting memos and notes to memorialize meetings and conversations. He's done this over the course of his career, and then he'll write these memos and he'll send them to his aides, you know, for kind of like to show that this happened and so people have evidence that he didn't write something later at a later date. And his memo regarding a White House meeting that he had with Trump, one of his memos said that Trump specifically asked him right after firing Flynn to stop investigating Flynn. He said to Comey, he's a good guy. I hope you can let this go. Now, that is what could be called obstruction of justice, and it is a road to impeachment. You know, now you have folks in Congress, you know, trying to subpoena any records of this conversation, and I don't know if they've gotten a hold of the actual memo yet, but, you know, there's other roads to impeachment, it seems, are opening up, is because after all this happened, there's an appointment of special counsel. Rod Rosenstein, who's a deputy AG under Sessions, and I don't want to get into kind of like when his memo came up and how Trump first relied on it to say that's why I fired Comey, because that's absolutely bullshit. But, you know, people kind of were attacking him, but then he went and he appointed a special counsel who was a highly respected person, former FBI Director Robert Mueller. And I think the powers given to the special counsel, the special prosecutor, are such that he's going to be able to do things that Congress is not going to be able to do, the other investigations have not been able to do, and are going to be beyond the reach of the Trump administration to really impact. So,
yes, but also remember that if he finds nothing, this whole issue is moot. So,
well, yes.
I just don't see that's a brief. Well, you know, it's true. If that happens, I'm not.
Just keep that in mind. It could happen.
I'm not putting a lot of, if Mueller concludes that, excellent.
It is what it is, right? I mean, like, I would trust it. If Mueller concludes it, I would trust it. Like I said, he comes to this position with a lot of credentials. I will say this. I mean, like, I've heard that once you're an agency man, you're always an agency man. So as a former FBI director, I'm sure he's going to feel very protective towards intelligence agency. And even, I think he's probably, I could be wrong, but I think he'll give more weight to Comey here than he would to Trump. But he's going to be investigating everything Russia related, and he'll have lots of resources, lots of subpoena power, and he can charge anyone but the president. So, and it does seem like to me that Trump might be, now he's kind of getting scared, and he has been tweeting and repeating that this appointment is now a witch hunt.
Well, I respect the move, but the entire thing has been a witch hunt, and there is no collusion between certainly myself and my campaign, but I can always speak for myself and the Russians, zero.
Are you hiring, and do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? It's not always easy finding the right person for your position and for your firm. But with ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to 100 plus job sites with just one click. Then their powerful technology efficiently matches the right people to your job better than anyone else. That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Because it's not like other job sites, ZipRecruiter does not depend on candidates finding you. It finds them. In fact, over 80% of jobs posted on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate in just 24 hours. No more juggling emails or calls to your office. Just screen, rate, and manage all your candidates in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. So find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, our listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/45. That's ZipRecruiter.com/45. One more time to try it for free, go to ZipRecruiter.com/45 and make finding the right candidate for your position easy as one click.
I will qualify this by saying this is not about an immediate concern. I will say my opinion on the odds of impeachment has shifted in light of the past week slightly from it's not going to happen to,
right.
Well, let's see what happens next. But as things currently stand, no, it's not going to happen. And there's a lot to indicate that even though it's very, very early stages and it's not like impeachment on the horizon kind of deal, it's a, you know, it's just a couple dozen more news stories away from it actually being a real thing. So let's position ourselves carefully kind of deal. The current whole kerfuffle, there's sort of the two different segments of it. There's the Flynn specific version and the Russian general version of why Trump's in trouble. Part of it said there were all kinds of contacts between the Trump campaign and the Russian campaign that they were lying about. And then part of it is just Flynn himself, the former national security advisor, who has Russia troubles and Turkey troubles and just lobbying and ethical issues, which Pence has frequently been brought in on. Now, Pence was the head of Trump's transition team. His duties included vetting candidates and making sure everything was done right, making sure there weren't people like Flynn on the team. And in the process of this, Pence told all kinds of factually inaccurate stories about Flynn. And to push back on that now, Pence has been saying all, like, every time one of these stories breaks, Pence goes out with stories and pushes the line that all these untrue things Pence said were just him repeating lies that Flynn had told him. And right now, there's nothing to show that Pence isn't right about this, that actually he really is just an incompetent idiot and he's not lying. But as Mueller starts his investigation, I would not be too surprised if we find out that actually Pence knew a lot more and knew it a lot sooner than he said.
Hasn't Pence repeatedly said that I did not know about Flynn having these ties? And that's already been disproven, right?
The first one that came up and that ended up getting Flynn fired was the conversations he had with the Russian ambassador, Kislyak, for about the sanctions. And here's Pence talking about what Flynn and the ambassador spoke about in mid-January.
What I can confirm, having spoken to him about it, is that those conversations that happened to occur around the time that the United States took action to expel diplomats had nothing whatsoever to do with those sanctions.
Now, this wasn't true. Flynn had discussed sanctions, telling the Russian ambassador to be patient, hold on, don't overreact, don't be hasty, we'll be in there soon, and you can expect sort of different treatment. And so what Pence said was a lie. Now, his version is that he was lied to by Flynn, and that's, he couldn't help it, but that wasn't the only untrue thing Pence said in that round of interviews. Here's another thing he said on January 15th.
So I'm asking you a direct question. Was there any contact in any way between Trump or his associates and the Kremlin or cutouts they had?
I joined this campaign in the summer, and I can tell you that all the contact by the Trump campaign and associates was with the American people. We were fully engaged with taking his message to make America great again all across this country.
But have you ever asked why he won in a landslide election? There were any contacts, sir? I'm just trying to get an answer.
Yeah, of course not. Why would there be any contacts between the campaign? Chris, this is all a distraction.
And this is also wrong, like flatly wrong. We know now that there were lots of contacts between Russia and the Trump team. So Pence is either completely ignorant of what his transition team was doing, or he's lying. So, you know, take
and
one
apparently
the other.
It recently reported that there were 18 unreported contacts between the campaign and Russia? Yeah.
18 additional after all the other ones reported.
I don't know, Susan. I can't say at all that I think Pence lied. I think that's going way too far. I think you have to understand that when this administration came, was when January 20th happened, we didn't know who the cabinet was going to be. Usually people running for...
Whoa, he knew who Flynn was going to be on
no,
there.
No, listen, if you look back, I'm pretty sure that Clinton would have known exactly who was going to be where if she would have win the presidency. But I think this administration was probably having issues with who to pick because this dude is coming from a completely different background. He doesn't have the connections. He doesn't really know the landscape. He has to pick people according to recommendations. So if Pence is saying he didn't really know all this stuff, it could very well be that, you know, they were just slamming together a cabinet.
But Pence is not Trump. Trump didn't know the landscape. Pence knows the landscape.
Pence was in charge of the transition team. He was in charge of vetting these people. Flynn was known for a long time and considered early. And also, if Pence is not a liar, here's what's happening. Pence has repeatedly gone on TV and told lies based on what Trump was telling him, based on what the administration was telling him. And those lies have gotten him in trouble. And they're all about Russia. Now, if you're working with someone who repeatedly says, don't worry, go tell everyone I'm not talking to Russia, it's not happening, and then you repeatedly find out that they lied to you, they were talking to Russia and had all kinds of stuff they were doing with Russia, wouldn't you be suspicious?
Maybe he is saying it like it is for him, and we just have to wait until there's some formal charges brought. I mean, you guys are lawyers. You know that in order for this to move a step further, you have to have evidence and you have to have people called out in a legal sense.
He's still protecting Trump. Why would you do that if someone kept lying to you about their secret interactions with a foreign enemy?
Well, maybe Flynn was lying from the get-go. I mean, what do you do? Like, constantly double-guess the person that
look,
you...
I think what Susan's getting at is you would do that because your butt is on the line, too. And you know it. You know it's a lie, and you're complicit in it. And I think that actually makes more sense than continuing to be shown false, even by the president himself, right? I mean, the president keeps admitting to things that his surrogates are like, no, he didn't do that. But I used to think that Pence was getting steamrolled by the administration, that he was kept out of the loop. And I know that happens with vice presidents. They're not always like very, very, you know, close to what's happening with the president. But I have shifted that train of thought in the last couple of weeks. And I think that he really has been trying to protect himself as well.
Yeah. His job is to know these things. It's not an excuse to say he just didn't know anything when he keeps going on TV and pretending he does. Now, so like I said, there's two issues, the Russia issue and the Flynn issue. And the other Flynn issue involves the fact that in 2016, his little consulting agency took on a $600,000 contract for the Turkish businessman, which was strangely representing Turkish government interest. He did not report this like he should have. He minimized what his role in it was, what was going on. And it didn't actually come out in full, or at least not in public, what all Flynn had been doing until after he had left the administration. However, what Flynn had been doing and the problems it was leading to was definitely well known before they even chose Flynn to do this role.
A question for you, Susan. At the time that that contract happened between Flynn and Turkey, obviously there was certain powers that needed his, you know, they were using him for consulting. And the U.S. had a certain view on Turkey, and it didn't seem to be problematic. So when you bring up
Whoa, how is that not problematic?
No, as in...
The non-disclosure is one of the big issues here, right?
Yeah, that...
Okay, here's the thing. In July, Flynn gives us like a little speech thing and talks about Turkey, and he supports the coup. He's saying, oh, it's good, they're going to be having a coup. In August, he gets a contract for $600,000, and suddenly he's like on the whole Gulen's a terrorist bandwagon.
Right.
That's a pretty stark change. Also, he lied about it, didn't disclose it, and didn't acknowledge that he was meeting with high-ranking Turkish ministers to discuss things like extraditing a U.S. green card holder to Turkey.
Where does his son come into the picture, too?
Yeah, so that's basically in March, when once the filing with the under the Foreign Aid Registration Act came out, they were talking to Pence about it. And Pence, here's what Pence said when he was asked on a cable news show about the Flynn story.
Michael Flynn has filed with the Department of Justice as a foreign agent for making more than $500,000 as a lobbyist, essentially, for Turkey. Your reaction to that, considering that, doesn't that mean, Mr. Vice President, that even if he didn't lie to you about what the Russian ambassador said or didn't say, that you would have had to fire him anyway?
Let me say, hearing that story today was the first I heard of it. And I fully support the decision that President Trump made to ask for General Flynn's resignation.
You're disappointed by the story?
The first I heard of it, and I think it is an affirmation of the president's decision to ask General Flynn to resign.
Now, if you parse Pence's words here, what he could have meant here, what he could say he was saying here, is that it was Flynn's filing under FARA that he first learned about, which there's not any reason to disbelieve. I mean, yeah. Pence wouldn't have known that Flynn was going to be filing this on this day, so that was probably the first time he learned about it. But on Wednesday of last week, Pence released another statement, this time clarifying that, yeah, he really had meant in March that he'd only learned that day for the very first time of Flynn's extensive ties to Turkey. The statement said, the vice president stands by his comments in March upon first hearing the news regarding General Flynn's ties to Turkey and fully supports the president's decision to ask for General Flynn's resignation.
That's incomprehensible. That's just unbelievable.
It's not true.
That's a total lie.
And then, it's a lie. It's straight up a lie because, again, he is the head of the transition. And this goes back to November 18th when Elijah Cummings, who was ahead of the ball, Representative Cummings wrote to Pence, and his letter said, I am writing to raise questions about the apparent conflicts of interest of the vice chairman of the presidential transition team, retired Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, who reportedly has been selected by the president-elect to be his national security advisor. Recent news reports have revealed that Lieutenant General Flynn was receiving classified briefings during the presidential campaign while his consulting firm, Flynn Intel Group Incorporated, was being paid to lobby the U.S. government on behalf of a foreign government's interest. Lieutenant General Flynn's general counsel and principal, Robert Kelly, confirmed that they were hired by a foreign company to lobby for Turkish interests, saying, they want to keep posted on what we all want to be informed of, the present situation and the transition between President Obama and President-elect Trump. When asked whether the firm had been hired because of Lieutenant General Flynn's close ties to President-elect Trump, Mr. Kelly responded, I hope so. Now, Cummings' letter also highlighted all the ways in which Flynn's activity with Turkey and his consulting gig was a conflict of interest, violated his ethics code, and violated the requirements of the memorandum of understanding between the Trump team and the Obama administration about handling confidential information and, you know, classified records. So in other words, Representative Cummings explained to Vice President Pence in detail why there was strong reason to believe that Flynn had engaged in behavior that made him a very serious security risk. And this happened on November 18th, the same day that he gets named as the National Security Advisor. And now Pence is claiming he had no clue until March of any of this, when it was widely reported in the news and kept increasing in the news as more stuff came out for months on end. And also, if you look back at the articles that were coming out during that time period, there's lots of people talking about the possible security risk that Flynn posed. Like there's one article from November 15th, 2016, had a person on the transition team talking about how they were warning that Flynn has some, quote, confirmation type problems, which means they were looking into his issues and they decided, you know what? There's no way Flynn can get confirmed by the Senate because he's batshit crazy. So we're going to put him somewhere that he doesn't need confirmation, which is probably why he ended up being shuffled into the National Security Advisor role.
So they downgraded it just to get him in without having to go through the...
It's not downgrading. It's a very serious, very,
it's a
like,
very important position.
Exposed role.
Well,
but
no,
also
I'm saying to just avoid that whole...
Right.
The scrutiny.
But it means they knew about it. It means they knew what they were doing, because they knew that he had some serious issues that couldn't pass scrutiny from the public. So yesterday, an article came out with the headline, source, Pence never informed about Flynn. And it was one of a series of articles from the Pence side, clearly him or his aides, saying like, oh my gosh, really, this Flynn stuff just crazy. We never knew about it. And like this, the article, the source cites a potential pattern of not informing the vice president and calling it malpractice or intentional and either unacceptable. And according to that article, the source, quote, is now saying that Pence and his team were not made aware of any investigation relating to Flynn's work as a foreign agent for Turkey. And it goes on to say the two men, according to the aide, never had a personal relationship and suggested the two may have never had a personal meeting during the transition.
Oh my God.
Who? Which two?
Flynn and Pence, which That's is incredible. Crazy revisionist history, because to see why, let's check another time when Pence made statements that were untrue and later claimed it's because Flynn lied to him. This is from December 6th, after Flynn's son had been fired from the transition team for promoting Pizzagate conspiracy theories.
His son had no involvement in the transition, but I've talked to General Flynn, and his son was helping him a bit with scheduling and administrative items, but that's no longer the case. Look, all of our families want to be helpful, and 4 weeks to the day from Election Day, there's been an awful lot of work to do, but Mike Flynn Jr. is no longer associated with General Flynn's efforts or with the transition team, and we're focused eyes forward.
You're downplaying his role, but you must be aware that the transition team put in for security clearance for Michael G. Flynn, the son of Lieutenant General Flynn.
Well, I'm aware in talking to General Flynn that his son was helping with scheduling, Jake.
No, but you put in for security clearance for him.
He was helping his dad arrange for meetings and provide meetings, but that's no longer the case.
But do you need security clearance to do scheduling?
I think that's the appropriate decision for us to move forward, avoid any further distraction, and... I'm very confident as we continue to build this team.
I'm afraid I just didn't get an answer, which is, were you aware that the transition had put in for a security clearance for Michael Flynn Jr.?
You know, I've worked very closely with General Flynn. We've met on many occasions. I've never seen his son present for any of those meetings.
But you're head of the transition team, so you know who you put in for security clearances for.
Well, General Flynn did inform me that his son was helping on administrative matters. But Jake... this is all the kind of distraction that frankly, I know, with all due respect, the national media likes to go chasing after.
Last question on this, sir, and I'm sorry, you're not answering the question, which is, were you aware that the transition team had put in for a security clearance? I mean, this is a young man who had a social media profile that had all sorts of crazy conspiracy theories, that had all sorts of links and retweets with white supremacists. Were you aware that the transition put in for a security clearance for him?
Well, what I can tell you is that in talking with General Flynn today, he made me aware that his son was assisting him in scheduling.
And that you'd put in for a security
meetings
clearance.
And whatever the appropriate paperwork was to assist him in that regard, Jake, I'm sure was taking place, but that's no longer the case.
And now Pence has done the same song and dance in a half dozen other interviews, but usually they're in friendlier venues or with journalists who don't do what Tapper did here, which is just refusing to move on until Pence is either forced to give an answer or makes very clear he's just a weasel who's obscuring the truth. I mean, Pence said it himself. He met with Flynn regularly and talked with him about all kinds of things. So the idea that he could somehow be head of the transition team, in frequent contact with Flynn, have his staffers who are in charge of all the serious vetting be aware of the fact that Flynn is a landmine who can't make it through the Senate confirmation process. And yet no one mentioned to him that there was something amiss and he never figured it out on his own. No.
And he was not consulted about the decision to bring him on. He never met him. What? That is just so beyond the pale.
You know what I worry about, guys? It's like we're barking up trees that, you know, are already kind of like, I mean, this is What would be interesting is if this continued, the investigation continued into a current sort of connection with people who are currently employed by the administration, and that leads to something. But to say that he's fired, this is behind us, and let's dig up what happened.
Why is it behind us? What? Let me ask you, why is it behind us when Pence...
He's gone. He's not in the picture anymore. Flynn's not in the picture.
Pence is.
This is true.
He lied to us. So either Pence knows that he's being fooled by the administration to carry out unethical behaviors by having someone who's compromised as a national security advisor, or he knew about it and was complicit with it. Like, there's no other option here.
Right. So you guys, it just isn't. As legal people, what are the constraints for him having his own consulting business and helping a foreign government? But then you have to understand there's foreign entities in this country who push their own agendas, which are very different from the agendas of that same entity back home in the native countries. And so Americans are largely unaware of the different agendas, and they can, you know, I'm not saying he was entirely innocent.
He's not entirely.
He
already broke the law. He already committed a criminal offense by not registering like he was required to. Like, it's flat out not a question there. Also, it's blatantly clear he was giving kickbacks in connection with that whole deal. So he's in big trouble. He's not getting out of this one clean.
Right. And Sarah, it's of course foreign governments have people here who are registered lobbyists for them. That's transparent. That's not the issue. The issue is having somebody in this particular sensitive position being, having a country like that as a client. And, you know, in one way, this impacted us. And this actually could have impacted
country
our national...
Country like what? Turkey's considered an ally.
Well, let me give you an example. Okay, so let me give you an example. Okay, you know what Flynn did? He derailed a military strike against ISIS. There was a planned military strike against ISIS that was going to be using the Kurdish paramilitary, okay? Now, you know that with Turkey, when it comes to Turkey, Erdogan, they do not want to empower the Kurds or the paramilitary. Yeah. So what happened was Flynn, because that is his client, he derailed this operation, okay? And so he effectively vetoed an operation that was believed to be in the national security interest of the U.S. because he had been paid huge sums by this client. This is how he derailed our military plans, our operations. And that is the danger here. Later, after he was fired, they actually did go ahead and go forward and work with the Kurds on this particular operation.
Yeah, that's the current program is to work with the Kurds.
It is.
Like,
but somebody
after he left.
But somebody like Flynn in that position, that is the danger of, like, you cannot serve both the United States, our interests, and the interests of another country at the same time. It cannot happen.
There's a reason that Flynn is at the center of all the investigations, because he is in so deep, he cannot get out.
Yeah.
He is on record, on paper, committing massive ethical violations and engaging in...
And it had to be really, really egregious. Yeah, it had to be really egregious for Trump to fire him, because I think Trump has a very high threshold for like misconduct when it comes to people surrounding him and himself.
Well, it's definitely not so much Turkey as it is Russia. Yeah.
So 4 days before Flynn signed this contract with the Turkish businessman, there are emails between Erdogan's son-in-law and son discussing their plans to affect the U.S. election. For instance, they had a plan to look for any U.S. congressman who had received donations from Gulenist. This is from Erdogan's sons. The proposed idea is, quote, did you know about Congressman XYZ took an all-expenses-paid trip to Turkey sponsored by this man? Proposed strategy. Call all opponents of congressmen running for office who have been paid by the Gulenists. And then, suggests the son-in-law, they should make contributions to congressional candidates if they sign a letter denouncing Gulen and asking state departments for its extradition, and then says the cost of this will probably be $20,000 to $30,000 per race. In other words, they're going to find people who got money from Gulenist and say, we're going to tell your opponents to use this as oppo against you unless you sign a letter denouncing Gulen. I mean, it's not like a super sophisticated plan, but it shows that they were doing, like, they had intentions to mess with U.S. elections by... essentially, on one hand.
Yeah, but I don't think that's... Listen, that's a Turkey thing. They've been doing this kind of stuff pre-Flynn. Regardless of Flynn.
Yeah, Flynn fell for it.
Well,
the question is, our national security, and like nobody working for the administration, nobody working in our government should be an agent of a foreign country. I mean, like this, I don't think that's like a really controversial thing to say, right, Sarah? I mean, like, you have to agree, right?
I agree with you on that. But he was functioning in his personal capacity And he was outsourcing his work to a foreign country. Yes. And if there was anything tricky, yes, I would say Pence would have to have known about that. And to say that they didn't know, what, they didn't do their due diligence. But I mean, I can't jump to the conclusion that anyone is lying, because this thing's ongoing. We have to look at the facts. We have to see what comes out first. So
he said he didn't know about it in March when he was informed repeatedly about it in November.
Well, given all the stuff they deal with, I mean, I don't know. Maybe he didn't know.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, you never know. Pence could also get impeached, too. I mean, we have no idea how far this is going to go.
God,
I mean, with Flynn, my understanding is subpoenas have been issued against Flynn. I'm pretty sure Flynn is going to be the first one to go down if it comes to criminal charges. And we'll see how that unravels. You know, but before everybody goes down in flames, although this might also be going down in flames, we got to talk about, I mean, as all this is unfolding, right, Trump's team is preparing for a very major and very bold, I would say, first excursion, international excursion for the president. Because normally, I mean, the last four administrations, the presidents, their first international trips have been like up north, down south, Canada or Mexico. This guy is like, nope, I'm going across the world. He's going to Saudi, he's going to the Vatican, and he's going to Israel. And Sarah, I'm going to turn it over to you to talk a little bit about what's going to happen in the Middle East.
So for me, I think the issue or the biggest story has been this Arab-Islamic U.S. summit that's happening with Trump's first trip to the Middle East. And it's being compared to Roosevelt's trip in 1945, where he met with the current King Salman's father. On Valentine's Day, it was on a U.S. Navy cruiser, the USS Quincy, in the Suez Canal, just after the Yalta summit. And that was supposed to signify the cornerstone of their relationship going forward. So this visit's kind of being compared to that. And it's actually not something that's out of the norm in terms of its goals, I think. But it's significant because I think it is a vamp up in our relationship with Saudi Arabia, but it's not a relationship that's new. It's been there for a long time. And so it's not that we're moving off track. It's just that we're strengthening whatever we set out to do initially. So this trip actually acknowledges the defense and security, as well as trade, investment, and economic cooperation that's going to increase between the two countries, and actually the larger Middle East and Arab nations as well, especially the Gulf states. The meeting's going to be with obviously GCC leaders and the representatives of 55 other Muslim majority nations. So there's never been a meeting like this before. And it's aimed to get these countries to work together against the threats posed by radical extremists and obviously Iranian interference in the Middle East at this point. And it's also aimed to bring end to a bloodshed that's currently happening in five of those 22 Arab countries. So I just wanted to quote somebody who's a Gulf state official who has not been named, but who made, a statement that's very poignant to me because it signifies the new feelings. And this goes back to a conference I attended right before the election of Trump. It was in October 2016. And it's a conference that's run by the National Council on U.S.-Arab Relations. And they meet every year. And they were especially excited at this conference because I think they really were rooting for Trump at that time. And of course, we knew that people were thinking Hillary would just definitely get the, you know, it was headed that way. But they seemed kind of very optimistic and they wanted to support Trump and his presidency. And this quote, I think, says it all. Quote, "A strong America is essential for a strong world. We badly want and need such a world. A weak America is a recipe for disaster. It is an invitation for other countries, Iran in our region, Russia here and others, behaving in ways that intimidate and undermine confidence in the future. Now, though, one can sense a change. Indeed, in practically every GCC country in the last month or so, Iran has been less mischievous than before. We think there's a direct correlation between Trump's coming and Obama's leaving." So one thing people have to know is the Middle East has been waiting for somebody like Trump. I think they felt that Obama's approach to the issues that they were facing was weak. It was not overtly very helpful in the sense that there were the troops on the ground, more involvement, kind of noticing and giving importance to the Arab nations and their struggles. It was more like whatever arms deals were happening, and it was a friendly, cooperative relationship, but it wasn't entirely satisfactory. So this visit has, I think, I broke it down into three main areas. It's financial benefits to both countries. It also is a positional statement. And of course, there's a military aspect as well. So looking at the financial situation, the current Saudi Arabia is not the Saudi Arabia we knew 20 years ago. The economy is dominated by oil, obviously, and has been for many decades. So oil is about 35 to 45% of the GDP of Saudi Arabia. And it's also the source of 75 to 80% of the government revenue and 85 to 90% of its export revenues. And they also sell petrochemicals, which are oil-based products. And that actually brings in the next largest amount of revenue from their exports. Saudi Arabia's income rose between 2002 and 14 because of the oil revenues. And so the government started spending a lot, and there was a lot of capital expenditures with public sector investments. But then there was, in May to June of 2014, the oil price collapse. And it's lasted up until 2016. And since then, oil prices have gone up, but it's been very kind of slow and volatile. So essentially, this country's changing from its focus on the oil to trying to diversify and find ways to keep its economy floating. And Saudi Arabia is actually very much in trouble, because what happened was it's gone into debt. It's now had to institute austerity measures, which are like cuts in salaries for people and the benefits for public sector workers and no bonuses. And, you know, there's been criticism of that because apparently the royal family continues to spend as much as it likes and it wants while it's been cutting what it's been giving to its citizens. So, again, there's unrest happening because of that. So we don't know what the future of oil prices is going to be. We just know that there's going to be a slowdown in the world economic kind of demand for oil, just as economies are slowing down in general, but also because we have alternatives like fracking and natural gas access that many countries are pursuing, and people are becoming more environmentally conscious. So the demand for oil is slipping some, which changes things for Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, the market's different now. It's not going to just go back to how it was before.
Yeah, and so now Saudi Arabia and other OPEC members have nowhere near the capacity that they once had to influence the level of oil prices. And Saudi's in such debt right now, they're pursuing, you know, they have a multi-billion dollar bond issue that could surpass Qatar, as it's got the highest amount of loans that it's taken away. And so this is going to be a huge problem for them. And I think what they're looking to do with Trump's visit is just revamp their economy. They're doing something, I think it's called the 2030 plan, and it's aimed at reviving the economy in a totally different way. It's doing things like seeking over $200 billion through privatization of its energy, health, education, agriculture, and mining. And then it's also selling 5% of its largest oil company, Saudi Aramco, which is trillions of dollars. And it's going to be selected. I mean, it's going to be sold through foreign stock markets. So this is where the U.S. comes in, because what they're going to start to do is increase investments in the United States, U.S. Treasury instruments they're going to be using, and deposits into U.S. banks and investment into the financial market. So it's a big financial deal for us, yes. And also, you know, it's not like oil's disappearing. It's still like it continues to produce nearly one third of whatever OPEC puts out. So oil is still a big part of it. So the financial benefits of this is like saving Saudi Arabia at a very critical time. And I think the other two things.
No, but let me ask you. Okay, are you saying that Trump's visit will help them? Will do what? Is the United States looking to buy that 5% of Saudi Aramco? Like, how are we going to financially help them? What's happening? I'm confused.
Well, there was a certain element of, there was an optimism in that room. And the reason was that they had figured out that they were going to ally with the U.S. or make the U.S. their main partner in trying to diversify their economies and start to invest in the United States in ways that weren't totally oil dependent. And that is what they're planning to do now. And this trip, I think, solidifies that whole goal that they had the stuff that I heard in October is actually materializing. And that 5% that they're liquidating, I think they're going to invest it in many places, but it's going to be primarily in the U.S. And I'm going to get into why I think at some point that gets a little scary as to, you know, Trump always talks about being independent, America first. But then if you're selling a lot of, you know, U.S. real estate and stock market stuff to a foreign country, how much is America first after a point? You know, where do we see the limits on that?
This is interesting to me because much of the news that I've been following about this trip has been actually around security issues and the creation of this, you know, this creation of this Arab NATO and the extremism stuff. And you're going to get into that. So I didn't really, but it makes sense. Why would oil not be an issue here? Obviously, our relationship is based on oil. So,
well, it's an economic thing. Okay. So if Saudi weakens, there's going to be huge a power struggle in the Middle East. It's going to be immense. I mean, Saudi has to be the number one force in the area. And so this is a huge financial move.
Number one Sunni source, right? Yeah.
Yeah. They want to vet the U.S. They want to stay alive. They understand the oil is finite. They know there's different alternative sources of energy and they want to be able to move with that. And look, they have a lot of political unrest. I mean, the austerity measures are not working that well. They have a huge youthful population, and they have to answer to that. There's got to be jobs available. People think the average Saudi Arabian is a wealthy person. That is just not true. Saudis are not all dripping in oil, and they're not all wealthy. They have Saudis out in tribal areas in the desert that have virtually nothing, and then they have people in the cities who survive on the welfare system that it has, and this is all at stake right now. So Saudi Arabia is really trying to vamp this up with the help of the U.S. And going back to what you were saying, Rabia, on the positional things that I see, it basically is a move to show solidarity against ISIS and Iran. It's definitely helping the Sunnis because Saudi Arabia is the largest, you know, is the home place of the faith in many ways for the Islamic world. And it also is pushing for a pan-Arab kind of solution, and pulling the GCC countries together. The GCC is made up of Bahrain, Kuwait, Oman, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE. And so these guys are all attending this meeting. They're going to be there. It's a kind of a morale booster in many ways because I think people are exhausted with the conflicts that are happening in that area. And I think it's got to be a reassurance to know that the United States is now supporting them, which they felt hadn't happened during Obama's time. So they've been waiting for this kind of leadership, and it marks a beginning of a new relationship that's going to be based on financial ties, but also understanding that oil's not going to last forever, and that, you know, in some ways, America is helping empower the Arab world to solve its own problems. So
What's interesting to me about that is that, you know, the idea of the United States helping the Arab nations empower themselves, right, and take care of their own problems. I mean, this is kind of like what we're hearing about. And it's not a new idea, the establishment of like kind of an Arab NATO type of thing where they have their own forces dealing with their own problems. But, you know, the analysis that I've read on that specific issue is that it really can't be executed because of the actual competition between these states themselves, right? Because of mistrust issues between the states, because vis-a-vis one another, they don't want to show their weaknesses. They also don't want to take on, they really want the U.S. to keep handling their security and matters.
You absolutely hit the nail on the head. The problem is their neighbors, their cousins, their brethren, but they don't always see things the same way. And they need this rallying cry from the U.S. to get everyone together because the problems are getting bigger and bigger. ISIS is a threat, and not just ISIS, but many of these countries have their own separate jihadist movements that they know that if their governments weaken are going to somehow rise up. And so this is a real problem. And yeah, I'm going to get to the part that I feel I'm skeptical of it because, I mean, you can't always have like a guy with a big stick coming in and telling you guys how to run things. Like, you have to know how to figure it out yourself. But this is a long time Arab problem. They've always had problems getting on the same page with this stuff. So in some ways, I can see, and I'm not judging this as much as I'm trying to explain where Saudi Arabia is coming from on this, and where the GCC countries and the Arab nations are coming, or other Muslim nations too, is they're trying to see if there could be a unifying force, because they are not very unified on this. And I think Trump, they've been rallying him for a while. And that pre-election conference that I went to was constantly laid down these things. This is what they wanted. This was their wish list. And honestly, they kind of got that after November. So our largest number of troops is not in Germany. Like, so we're not looking at a post-World War paradigm anymore. It's been the GCC countries, and Saudi is the capital of those GCC countries. So that's why he's going to Riyadh. And also, Saudi has one of the largest defense burdens in the world. According to the International Institute of Strategic Studies, that Saudi Arabia's military spending accounted for 12.7% of its GDP in 2015 and 8.9% in 2016, making it fourth, just behind the U.S., China, and Russia. So their military needs are very huge. And despite the rise in oil, Riyadh is like one of the biggest consumers of U.S., you know, military equipment.
And by the way, you know, I also read that despite the fact that we have a one of our most prominent military presence in this country, that those the heads of those countries are actually not satisfied. They want a more permanent U.S. military presence there. They want more troops. I mean, like, that it's kind of crazy to me that, you know, as back home here, we call for less intervention. We think the U.S. should pull out of the Middle East. I mean, like, when I say we, I mean, like, a whole array of people from Trump supporters to progressives. But in the Gulf countries, that those heads of state, they actually want more U.S. military. And I think it's because it's the same thing. Well, you know what? They want us to pay to protect them. I think that's what's really happening.
And, you know, it's sad for me because I grew up in a Gulf state. I grew up in Kuwait, and I didn't go – I left Kuwait 4 days before the invasion happened when Saddam invaded. And it was just by chance because we got our green cards, right? So fast forward 2007, I'm going back to Kuwait with four little babies to visit where I was born. And at every corner, I see a Burger King with military people. And I'm going, this is not the Kuwait that I used to know, but this is what they want. This is what they need. And it's kind of sad, but, you know, nothing's changed. It's just a vamp up of the same stuff. And yes, until the Arab states learn to get along with each other, get on the same page and have really, truly, intrinsically valuable common interests, there's going to have to be an outside force that always brings them together. And that is the U.S. right now. So... But also, just before leaving, I think Jared Kushner kind of struck a deal with Saudi to give a portion of that $110 billion up ahead of his of the trip. And that was in the amount of about $98 billion. So I see this is where I find the problem. It's I don't see where the common, I mean, a bunch of different officials kind of sitting in a room and going through this. It was reported that Jared Kushner just picked up the phone, made a phone call to Lockheed Martin and asked for a reduction in the price of some of the military equipment they're sending. And they said they'd look into it. It's the manner in which it's being conducted that is a little bit concerning to me because it's back to that whole business transactional way of dealing with things when we're not looking at you know, fine. We are giving the U.S. I mean, we are giving Saudi arms for God knows how long. We've always been doing it. But was this the way we did it where, you know, a president's son-in-law picks up the phone and makes the deal happen? That just makes me really uncomfortable.
When the king's son-in-law asks for a favor.
Yeah.
And say no very carefully.
Well, here,
not at all.
You hit on a good thing because that's what's different here is the personal ties between the families in this.
And the lack of oversight. I would say the lack of oversight, right? I mean, so you have...
You said it, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like, you don't have the people making these choices who are, like, experienced, qualified veterans of these international relations and understanding this stuff. And I feel like what's happening is, like, you have people like Kushner and others who... Stephen Miller, I mean, who's like gonna crazy Stephen Miller is gonna be writing like major speeches to NATO and Trump and not understanding the implications of what they are doing long term. So that's my, you know, it might not be illegal what he's doing, but I think that it, you know, I just don't trust their judgment on these things. We don't know what the unintended consequences of this stuff could be.
Well, I think from following on from that conference I attended, I thought that the rains or the predicted rains would be the U.S. military and Saudi Arabia calling the shots on what this relationship is going to look like. And I think that has actually played out because now we have McMaster and Mattis heading the way on this stuff in terms of the military and Saudi's making its requests off Trump and things are happening in a business deal kind of fashion. And you're right, the oversight, like where are the other agencies? Where are the other experts who are going to be making joint decisions with them? That's a little concerning to me. But then of course, as much as I know and I understand why we have to have a relationship with Saudi Arabia and why we're doing this, and you know, I grew up close to that area, so I have an affinity for the people. They're beautiful people. They're, I mean, did I sound like somebody?
tremendous yeah, people. Really.
But look, they're the most hospitable human beings you've ever come across, and to me, it's like, you know, in many ways, it's very endearing. But at the same time, these are not the people making the decisions here. So I have a lot of problems with this relationship that's kind of brewing. And some of it, a lot of it has to do with Yemen. I mean, here we have the biggest humanitarian crisis that's occurring on our watch in Yemen, and yet we're arming the country that's going to be doing this. And whatever the geopolitical reasons are, there are people dying here. And who's addressing that part in this whole thing? That's one thing that really, I can't sleep at night thinking about that. And then where is Putin in this whole thing? I mean, we just had him come, Lavrov just came here and had that little stuff that happened in the White House. But where is Putin on this whole thing in terms of Assad, Syria, ISIS, Iran? Don't hear anything about that. And my other point is this. ISIS isn't the only group out there. And when you have a head of state who's been so sort of militaristic in his approach and bombastic in his speech, arrive on Saudi soil, and Saudi soil is considered the is like the keepers of the faith, right? How are these jihadi groups going to react? Are they going to feel like, oh my gosh, America's really getting its claws into places that shouldn't be? Are we going to see a vamp up of these attacks? Are we going to see other jihadi movements come up or strengthen? That's one thing I'm worrying about. I don't know if anyone else is thinking about that. That leads to more civilian deaths.
Well, here's, you know, look, my response to that is I think jihadi groups are pissed off no matter what. I mean, Trump comes, they're going to be, I don't think they need necessarily an excuse.
True,
and I certainly don't think we should calibrate our actions, you know, in terms of, oh, how will ISIS respond to this?
I don't think so.
Yeah.
I'm just saying there might be more civilian. I mean, I'm wondering what will be said and done while he's there that will contribute to this or compromise the safety and security.
Next week's episode will be great because all kinds of crazy stuff is going to be said and done. I'm convinced of it.
Given that Saudi's been in charge of that, you know, that commission out in the UN on human rights, and there's a lot of issues with how we are not putting that on the table as something that we need to be negotiating.
Isn't it actually women's rights and more specifically so than human
women's
rights?
Women's rights are human rights.
Yeah.
This should
yes.
be equated. This is what the
but
world's
also,
doing wrong. The world's doing this wrong. Women's rights are human rights.
Tillerson's also said that we're no longer going to make U.S. interest contingent on other countries respecting human rights.
Right.
We're no longer in the business of caring if other countries have human rights.
Yes, and but then we're contributing to...
We are.
and that is something that I think the leaders of these particular countries will applaud. They're mostly strong men. These are people who want... These are not democratic nations that want to give power to the people.
Really quickly, I have to say that there is an argument to be had that perhaps with the economic alliances that things would open up a little bit, and so that could lead to more women's rights and stuff in the country. Because listen, when you have business dealings that improve, you obviously are exposed to each other's cultures and economies. But yeah, and so maybe it might help indirectly. I don't know. I'd like to say that if the U.S. economy is tied heavily with the stock market investments by Saudi Arabia, how much can we keep America first?
We can't.
But Trump might get his Trump Jeddah property through in Saudi.
I think it's Trump first. I think let's be honest here. We can keep Trump first as long as Mueller doesn't bring him down. So I'm going to wrap up by thanking our listeners for tuning in this week. I hope you enjoyed the conversation. As you could tell, there was a lot more we even wanted to talk about. I don't want to keep you on the podcast for hours and hours, but we will be back next week. And we wanted this week, as we always do, to get to listener questions and calls and emails. And I promise we are paying attention to them. We listen to them. I think what we're going to do is we're going to try to do those separately and then maybe pop those online during the week, separate from our episode. So don't worry. Please keep sending in your listener comments, questions, suggestions. We are paying attention. Thanks again, and we will see you guys next week. Thanks for tuning in again this week, and we really hope to keep coming to you weekly, but in order to do that, we do need your support. So please consider becoming a patron of the 45th Podcast. To do that, just go to our Patreon page. It's www.patreon.com/45thpod. Again, that's patreon.com/45thpod, and Patreon is spelled P-A-T-R-E-O-N. A big thank you, of course, to everybody who helps make this show possible, beginning with our fantastic sponsors. Thank you for supporting us. Thank you to Ray Gaines for our audio production, our kick-ass producer, Mithal Thelhan. Thank you. You are the best. We have been produced by Long Arc Digital Media, and you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Our handle is @45thpod. Please do check out our website at www.45thpod.com. And you can reach us and leave us your listener messages, which we love to check into, at 202-670-8345. Again, it's 202-670-8345. Thanks again. See you guys next week.
What they wanted. This was their wish list. And honestly, they kind of got that after November. So,
and everyone knows that Trump voters really want a candidate dedicated to a platform of make Middle East great again.
Oh, Middle
East great again. You know what I'm waiting for? I cannot wait for two things. The photographs to come out of Trump holding hands with some of those in line for succession, some of the crown princes, and also that Toby Keith, that concert that's gonna be all men. There's a Saudi lute player, and then you have our superstar country singer Toby Keith, who's gonna be giving an all male concert. So I think that's gonna go really well with the MAGA crowd, the Make America Great Again, the holding hands with the anyway. But I'm
a country music fan. Okay,
I am too. But Toby Keith is not the representative I want to send out to Saudi Arabia.
Well, Keith may be the only one that said okay.